Are you looking to give your immune system a boost? This is Dr. Ronald Hoppen with a natural solution from Future Farm Botanicals, liquid wild oil of oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's wild oil of oregano supports a variety of health benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate wild oil of oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. Future Farm sources this product from the Mediterranean and produces it in the United States. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions, your most pressing questions related to issues around intelligent medicine. And we'll continue with those questions. What's next, Layla?
We have a question from Mona. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I was catching up on your podcast the other day, and you mentioned that you might revisit and talk about your protocol for Parkinson's disease. And I have a question about vitamin B6. I haven't heard all your podcasts, but I haven't heard you mention the connection between these two. So, a little bit of a backstory here. Mona's father went through some chemotherapy at the age of 78 for a metastasized cancer, and he came out of that chemo with Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm.
And Mona is wondering if, you know, if B12 might have been helpful or may be helpful. I know there's been some study on B12, and what they found is that an association of low intake of vitamin B6 was actually associated with an increased risk of Parkinson's disease, independent of other confounders, and possibly independent of homocysteine levels.
Mm-hmm.
Because increased homocysteine might accelerate dopaminergic cell death in Parkinson's because it's neurotoxic. So the fact that B6 is one of the vitamins, along with B12 and folate, that can help to lower homocysteine,
mm-hmm.
that it might be helpful. But what they also found is that B6 in and of itself was helpful.
Yeah.
But the association was decreased
in incidence. So here's the deal with B6 mm-hmm. and Parkinson's. As you say, Parkinson's disease is a neurodegenerative disease, and neurodegenerative diseases may be associated with methylation problems.
Yeah.
The B vitamins are essential for methylation, so yeah. B12, B6, and folate are associated with the production of neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm.
The key neurotransmitter that's deficient in Parkinson's is dopamine.
Yeah.
And so, as you say, B6 deficiency may impair the production of dopamine, and B6 may support dopamine production. But here's why B6 is a little controversial in Parkinson's. Patients, not that much anymore, but they used to take L-DOPA, the medication, one of the oldest medications around for Parkinson's, which is a precursor to dopamine, but B6 interferes with its L-dopamine's conversion to dopamine. So B6, if you're taking L-DOPA, they'll say don't take B6. However, most people are taking a more modern drug, which is Sinemet, which is levodopa plus carbidopa.
Okay.
So when you combine carbidopa with levodopa, it obviates the problem with B6, and B6 can't suppress the synthesis of dopamine.
So,
you know, that's an answer to this conundrum, because B6 got a little bit of a bad rap with Parkinson's patients because of this potential drug interference.
Yeah.
It is not that consequential, since I can't remember a patient who's just on L-DOPA. Maybe some neurologists out there can verify that for us and shoot us an email.
I think another reason B6 gets a bad rap is that a deficiency will have the same symptoms
as a major overdose,
right. Which is all neurological.
Which is, you know, ataxia is the main thing. Like
which is a feature of Parkinson's, you know, it's like gait problems, gait problems. So that, I guess, you know, if you massively take B6 in the absence of other B vitamins, maybe you can develop this. That actually, the toxicity of B6, we actually discovered at Einstein while I was at medical school up there in the Bronx in the 1980s. So it got a lot of play, but I think it's overplayed. And, you know, just as an aside, I see a lot of doctors, neurologists, especially when patients have neurological problems, they test patients for B6 and they go, oh my God, it's the B6 that's causing your problems. Anybody who takes even like a very strong multi or a B complex.
That might have 15 milligrams of pyridoxine.
It's going to show as if they have too high B6, but it's not, it doesn't mean they're toxic with
B6.
The range that they set for B6 is very conservative. So they'll say, oh my goodness, are you taking B6? Oh, God, get off that stupid thing.
Right.
No, but don't, mostly that's not a problem.
Okay. So, Mona, we hope that answers your question. Thank you very much for that email. Oh, here's an interesting one. And this kind of coincides now with Dr. Hoppen. You've seen the headline about don't bother fasting when you go to get your cholesterol checked.
Big time. I've seen it. Yes.
Yeah. Well, this comes from Cindy. Hello, Dr. Hoppen and Layla. I listen faithfully to every podcast. I'm so grateful for all the intelligent medicine and nutrition education offered by both of you. Cindy, thank you for listening. My sister recently had a physical that included a typical lipid panel, right? She came in fasting.
Cholesterol, HDL, triglycerides.
All of that. She was borderline high, so I suggested that she go on bergamot instead of taking a statin. Well, that was fine. Last week, she went back for the yearly physical and was shocked to see that the cholesterol numbers moved in the wrong direction. What was the difference? She came in unfasting, not fasting, to have her lipid levels checked.
Right.
So I saw a study written in the Journal of American Medical Association that states fasting is no longer necessary. Thus, she made an afternoon appointment, had her blood drawn after lunch. Note, my sister is a very selective eater. There were no changes to her diet or lifestyle during the last year.
Okay.
So what are your thoughts about fasting versus non-fasting?
Well, you have
with
a theory
regard
about
to
that.
Getting your...
You have a theory about that.
Oh, well, yeah.
It's kind of a...
shall I say?
It's kind of a perverse theory about
it's
that.
It's a little perverse, but I'll say it here on Intelligent Medicine. I said, yeah, I think they no longer care if you're fasting or not, because when you're not fasting, your lipid profile will likely be somewhat higher, and that might be more of a reason to put you on a statin.
Which they pretty much... which they're looking to do anyway.
Right.
Yeah. So here's the deal. It depends.
Yeah.
And the crucial difference is associated not with cholesterol, but triglycerides. Okay. So here's how that works. Mathematically, for every 100 points of triglycerides that you have, you can add 20 points to your cholesterol. And it's all VLDL cholesterol, which is non-HDL cholesterol. It's the so-called bad cholesterol.
Right.
So it's mathematical. It so say this person fasting has a triglycerides of 100, hypothetically. And then they are, you know, come in after lunch, especially a lunch that's high in fructose or starch, which will raise the triglycerides in some people. Some people tolerate triglycerides genetically, but also based on their metabolic status. If you're obese, if you're syndrome X, if you're pre-diabetic, you will have a greater tendency to have hypertriglyceridemia, which is actually more of a problem, I think, than high cholesterol.
It's an independent risk factor.
So anyway, so let's say, you know, it goes from 100 to 300, which is possible. I mean, we've seen people with triglycerides of 500, 600, you know, higher, although that's rare. That will do the math. Take that 200 additional points or 300 and divide it by 5, and you get 50 or 60 points additional cholesterol of the brown kind. So it is actually technically not true that it doesn't make a difference. Where it doesn't make a difference is in people who are fit, who, you know, like me, if I'm fasting, my triglycerides will be, you know,
30.
40, 50, 30, 40, 50, maybe.
Yeah.
And if I've eaten, they might be 70, 80, 90,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, big meal.
Yeah.
They're not going to go up that much.
Right.
But have you had your blood tests lately? Does it
not lately? No, I haven't.
That's funny because you look at so many blood tests. You say,
I know.
I gave it the office.
I gave it the office, exactly. What's interesting is Cindy tells us her sister's numbers, and she gives us three numbers.
Let's see.
No, total cholesterol,
yeah.
LDL, and HDL.
Yeah.
There's no mention of triglycerides.
But
yeah, so it's the triglycerides, Cindy.
But what are the numbers?
The total cholesterol went from a 229 to a 254. That's non-fasting versus
So one might predict 150 points on the triglycerides.
Right. So her LDL went from a 140 fasting to 161 non-fasting.
Hmm.
And the HDL went down from 71 fasting
got crowded
to
out.
A 64.
Yeah, that's a little.
It probably got suppressed by the triglycerides, of which we don't know the number.
Yeah, that's a little weird because
triglycerides will slap down the HDL.
Triglycerides are supposedly going to affect LDL, VLDL cholesterol, not LDL cholesterol.
Yeah.
So, you know, but the body is dynamic and things change, you know.
True. Yeah. Yeah. So, Cindy, tell your sister not to fret. It's probably better to continue fasting, even though they say don't bother.
What was her HDL at best?
At best was 71 and went down to a 64 when she came in not fasting.
It is, although this person has high cholesterol, it's conceivable that she doesn't have any cardiovascular risk, although
yeah.
we don't know
yeah.
without doing an EBT heart scan.
Right, right. Well, she had a CT scan of her heart about 6 months ago
yeah.
that resulted in a cardiac calcium score of zero.
Bingo! That's the answer.
That's the answer.
We're done.
That's it. She doesn't have to worry, Cindy.
Right. No, but she might
despite
have,
the fact that her cholesterol non-fasting is 254.
There are other consequences. I mean, she might have a higher risk of, you know, prediabetes, cerebrovascular disease. It's possible, but
yeah.
This is a really, I'm glad we elicited that fact
yeah.
because here's what a lot of people would say, that's not a good cholesterol. Oh my God, you know, and virtually every internist I know would jump on that cholesterol and try and fix it.
Yes.
But
yeah.
Presented with the evidence that there's zero plaque, they might listen to reason.
Mm.
Some of them might not. They might say, yeah, well, you have zero now, but, you know, we don't know. It could eventually get to be, you know.
I've heard doctors say, I've heard patients tell me that their doctors have said, no, that's not a very reliable test.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's speak to that a little bit.
Okay.
There is this fly in the ointment, which is you might have zero calcific plaque, but you might have non-calcific plaque or atherosclerosis that doesn't show up.
Mm.
So what in the future, it's coming down the pike, is tests that will measure plaque and differentiate between the pathogenic plaque that is more likely to cause a heart attack
mm-hmm.
Versus the stable plaque,
yeah.
which is thought to be less risky.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's in the works.
It's in the works.
And it's not yet ready for prime time, but within the next next decade, in this decade that we're in, we will see tests that will better differentiate.
Mm.
So that might help a person who, say a person has a plaque score of 250.
Yeah.
It's a fairly high plaque score, but there's plenty of people who happily live to, you know, 105 with a plaque score of 250.
There you go.
But, and there are people with a score of like 110 who have a heart attack. So how do you know? There's some plaque score. You can differentiate, you can actually subtype the plaque
yeah.
to say this is benign and this is risky plaque.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's
so we'll
in the works.
We'll see what happens.
I've seen the papers on that.
Okay,
good point at which to pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share an important message with you. So here goes. Listen up.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you in this new decade. And now, what's the next question?
Got to get used to writing 20. You 20. Know, write the date.
20. I already goofed it up today.
I did too. Yeah. Okay. This comes from Jacob. Dear Dr. Hoffman, in late October, you interviewed Dr. Langsgen on CoQ10 and ubiquinol.
His father is like the godfather of coenzyme Q10, so it's a family thing. Mm-hmm. And I believe also his son, Dr. Langsgen, who was just a young physician when his father was doing his work, his son is now a cardiologist.
Who's
So
the third.
It's a dynastic thing. They're the CoQ10 ubiquinol dynasty.
Dynasty, yeah. Towards the end of the program, you asked him if it's a good idea to measure the blood levels of CoQ10, and Dr. Langsgen said that that doesn't measure the CoQ10 level. It's really the ratio between total cholesterol and CoQ10. He did not mention what the ideal levels of serum CoQ10 should be.
Right.
Could you add?
Well, you know, I think that that's controversial. I mean, this guy's one of the foremost researchers in CoQ10. Mm. If you talk to Stephen Sinatra, who, by the way, is a disciple of Dr. Langsgen, Dr. Sinatra believes that you should virtually treble, get three times the level of CoQ10 when you measure in the blood to achieve a therapeutic level. Mm. I think that there is controversy in research about how much you need in different circumstances. Like if you're a heart failure patient,
you need loads.
You need loads of it. And a blood test isn't going to tell you how much you need. Mm. A blood test might give you some signposts, but it's more to, you titrate to the response. Like, you get from an injection fraction of 20 to an injection fraction of, 45. Wow. By taking, 600, 800, 1200 of CoQ10, or a little less ubiquinol since it's more bioavailable.
Right, right. So the other circumstance I could see taking loads of CoQ10 and ubiquinol is Parkinson's disease, which we were just talking about a little while ago. So that's very interesting. That's very, very interesting. Jacob says, thanks a lot for very informative programs and wonderful service to educate the public. I wish my doctor would listen to your programs, Jacob says.
Well, with deference to your doctor, I think doctors these days are so harried, so tired, so overworked.
7 minutes a patient.
And then they're required also to go through a recertification process where it's almost like a mini med school, where they have to cram a lot of facts, and they don't get tested on this stuff. They get no credit for spending time learning about that. So I give the highest commendation to any physician who's busily involved on the front lines of medicine and dealing with the insurance companies and dealing with the electronic medical records and dealing with the fear of, liability and all this stuff that they deal with on the daily, and the horrible working conditions in many cases, the pressures, the productivity quotas, and blah, 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 blah.
Electronic medical records.
Threat of discipline, and, getting reviewed by your hospital for, not prescribing the right medications or whatever, that they actually take time in their little spare time they have for their personal lives. They got to have a life.
Right.
Time for family and, some R&R.
Medical
that they would take time to learn this stuff is remarkable.
They're becoming automatons between the guidelines and the little time you get to spend per patient. It's not the way to do things, right? I do want to say to Jacob that I personally notice a difference when I take CoQ10 or when I take ubiquinol.
Yeah.
Ubiquinol is a little more up. Uh-huh. Up. Now, I don't know if that's because I know which thing I'm taking.
It's a good
there has to be that kind of a bias, too.
Right.
So if I were to, say, have my husband say, here, shuffle these up and give me one and then give me the other one and don't tell me which one.
Three-card Monty.
Right.
with the cups.
And then I'll see what happens.
With the cups, right?
Right. So it's interesting. There you have to take that into consideration, the placebo or nocebo effect or something, but
it's a fair bet, that as we age, we're synthesizing less CoQ10 or ubiquinol, and it's You know, I think that along with nicotinamide riboside and things like NT factor are very good for supporting the mitochondria, along with, of course, the B vitamins and magnesium and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
Good time for a quick question. Do you have something?
We have here, okay, from Michael. Hi, Dr. Hoppen and Layla. Some integrative MDs, not all, contend that the optimum amount of vitamin D3 should be between 80 and 100. However, Dr. Cooper of Consumer Labs, in his review of the research on vitamin D3, says it indicates that the studies indicating D3's benefits were done on people having less than 30 in their blood. And any increase, according to the research, after that amount would not provide any additional benefits and indeed may be counterproductive.
You know, and that's controversial. And I have to say that I keep looking at the literature on that, and it's the question is, do we want to get, you know, mid-range, like, you know, 30, 40, is that enough? You know, 50, I sort of like 50,
60. I like 50, between 55 60. And 80.
Yeah, well, sort of like
just
the,
right there.
I like sort of like the speed limit on the, you know, expressways. You know,
55.
There's some.
Well, you know, everybody's going 70.
No,
do
I know.
Notice?
I was on.
I noticed. I'm like.
I was going like.
They're speeding by. I'm going 63 miles an hour. They're speeding by.
I was going 70. I'm getting cars are whizzing by. But
anyway.
So with regard to vitamin D, I think there are some doctors who are so enamored of vitamin D that they say everybody should have it like 80 to 100 is the way to go. And you know, I'm not sure. It may be therapeutic for certain conditions like MS. I really like very high doses of vitamin D. For autoimmune conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, I like really high doses. It appears though that it's really complicated because in inflammatory conditions, of which MS is an example, and ulcerative colitis are another example, there's a depletion in rheumatoid arthritis, certainly an inflammatory condition. It depletes the D, so you have to take more to get to a level that's acceptable. So it's situational.
Yeah.
You know, also there's some additional benefits to sunlight that you may not get from taking it orally. So, for example, for eczema, we know that vitamin D deficiency is associated with eczema. But taking vitamin D orally will help a little bit, but getting sunlight on your skin and production of vitamin D in the skin, which is the site of the inflammation, is better than taking it orally and trying to push it in through from the inside out.
Right.
So, you know, I think there needs to be a lot more research on this. I think as with many enthusiasms, we went from fearing vitamin D, then we went to recognizing it was helpful, then we became fanatical about vitamin D, and there may be a correction, a little bit of a correction in the wind.
There is also the idea of the genetic SNP for the vitamin D receptor. We have to take that into consideration.
And it's complicated. There's several associated with vitamin D metabolism.
Oh, my. Yeah. That's going down a rabbit hole to some degree.
Yeah.
Not completely.
With our genetic testing, we can sometimes predict that people are going to require more to get healthy. It's it ain't settled science yet.
Right, it's
but
not.
You know, there are these studies that vitamin D does no good. I mean, of course that's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
You know, it is.
It's very,
very
helpful,
beneficial.
Very beneficial for autoimmunity, for cancer, for blood pressure, for not just bone health. So
even, you know, blood sugar metabolism and so on and so on. In spite of the fact that some studies are gonna come up, you know, blank on that.
Yeah.
So, you know, studies, got to be wary of some studies.
Yeah.
All right, that's all the time that we have for today's edition of Intelligent Medicine. Thank you, Layla. I want to wish our audience a very happy new year. I hope you stay with us in 2020 for reliable health news.
Yes.
Yep.
We'll
be back
everybody.
Next week with more of our weekly Q&A with Layla. Radio program at AOL.com is where you can send questions. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoppen.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.